Today on Off Mic, the COVID-19 epidemic is having a profound effect on the United States, Indiana, and right here in Northwest Indiana. We bring you the latest numbers and we talk about the trends facing the region. We also talk to two Chicago area reporters on how the way journalists are reporting these days is changing because of the pandemic, along with vital institutions like airlines and transit hurting big time. We hear from one young college student on the effects this is having on her. And during this time of need, local groups are stepping up. All this on Off Mic. First, the news. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. The latest numbers from the Indiana State Health Department paint a grim picture on the state of the state with COVID-19. 981 positive cases, 24 deaths, nearly 7,000 people tested. Here in Northwest Indiana, 60 confirmed cases, with 47 in Lake County alone. So where is this all going and what does it all mean? Joining me to talk about the trends with COVID-19 is Dr. Micah Pollack, Associate Professor of Economics at Indiana University Northwest. So, Doctor, I know you've been tracking the positive cases that are coming through Indiana and Northwest Indiana, and the numbers this morning, you know, are continuing to be very disturbing. What are some of the trends have you been seeing in some of your research?
Sure. So, the state of Indiana has been doing a great job posting all the numbers by county. But what I was most interested in was two things. One was how quickly cases were growing. So the growth rate, they post total numbers, but not growth rates. And then the other thing I was interested in is the percent of tests that are positive, because that can give you an idea of how many undiagnosed cases are out there. Because, you know, if you're not testing, then you don't detect the positive cases. And so that was kind of the drive for me starting to look at this. And we do see very quick growth rates in Northwest Indiana. Since March 16th, it's been growing about 50% per day in terms of positive cases, which is basically doubling every 1.7 days.
So as we're projecting this out, I mean, what kind of what can we gain from this? Only because a lot of these numbers are coming when the stay-at-home order was before that was administered and more people are, I guess, taking this quote-unquote seriously. Is there anything you think that might start bringing these numbers down?
Well, certainly the stay-at-home order will help. And, you know, I think seeing these numbers now, even though they don't reflect, you know, the stay-at-home effects yet, will hopefully be a reminder for people that it is important to stay at home. You know, one of the challenges with this virus is that it has such a long incubation period that we, you know, don't see real effects from things like the stay-at-home order until maybe a week or more after it's been put in place.
You know, in some of your graphs and charts that you've been putting out there on your Twitter account, and I would suggest a lot of people, if you are not following Dr. Pollack, that you may want to do that now. But you're seeing that even the growth rate here in Northwest Indiana is surpassing the national average, and it's almost right there with the Indianapolis area, correct?
Yeah, and I don't think that's surprising. I mean, we are right adjacent to Chicago, which has, you know, some of the faster growth rates. I mean, we're not to the, you know, Chicago's not quite at New York City levels yet, but it seems like it might be on track to go there. And, you know, we are a pretty big urban kind of metropolitan area. So, you know, people interact with each other. People travel around a lot, commute to Chicago. So they are very high numbers. I don't think it's that surprising. I think we're going to see even higher numbers as time goes on.
What are some of the trends are you going to be following, say, in the next week or so as these numbers continue to come out?
Well, I'm particularly interested in what this is going to do to the economy as an economist. And yesterday, you know, just as a early, you know, kind of preview of what may be coming, you know, we had unemployment insurance claims released. And so for the week ending March 21st, there were 3.3 million new unemployment insurance claims. The previous week, we had 282,000. So that's a 3 million increase in the number of unemployment insurance claims in the United States, which is five times the highest it's ever been in the history of the United States. And so this is just kind of a early preview of what things are going to look like probably in the next few weeks and months.
You know, Doctor, a lot of people have been talking, obviously, about the stimulus package and people need it, but it almost seems like now with all the unemployment claims here in Indiana, just yesterday they were saying it's already up to past 62,000 people have already filed for unemployment in Indiana. It seems like $2 trillion may just be a drop in the bucket.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even if every person in the United States is handed a check for $2,000, I mean, that'll get you for a family of four, you know, through a month, maybe if it pays your rent and some food. But this looks like it's going to probably drag on much longer than a month. Certainly the economic effects are going to be, you know, extensive and last for years.
Right. And this is something I know, of course, the president's been talking about it, that a lot of people are optimistic that once this is over, the United States will be able to bounce back from this in relatively short period. But it seems to me, especially when you're talking about the economy of Northwest Indiana, it could take a long time for this area to bounce back, considering some businesses that are closing may not reopen once this is all over.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, especially like food service, restaurants, entertainment, recreation, a lot of these places don't have, I mean, they may have cash on hand to survive for a while, but, you know, usually that may be a week or two, you know, and here we may be talking months. And so I think the businesses that you see shutting down now or trying to find ways to continue to operate, a lot of them may never reopen again.
All right. Dr. Mika Pollack is an associate professor of economics at Indiana University Northwest in Gary. Dr. Pollack, thank you so much for joining me here on Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Great. Thanks for having me, Mike.
When we come back, we talk to NPR's David Shaper on how the coronavirus epidemic is causing havoc with the airline industry.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Well, the coronavirus update, coronavirus 19 is having an impact on all aspects of life, on traveling either by air, by train, or by boat. And here to talk about this, who's been covering a lot of the transit issues, is NPR's David Shaper. Hey, David, how are you?
I'm good, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and thank you for joining us here on Off Mic. David, you do a lot of traveling in your profession and getting out to stories and everything. Are you doing a lot of traveling these days?
Not at all. I'm not even traveling out of my house much, like a lot of people. And it's kind of a change. I think I was in the air three different trips in February.
Wow.
Maybe four. And then since early March, I haven't gone anywhere. It's been a drastic change for a lot of people. I mean, there's a lot of business travelers who are literally traveling every single week of the year that they're not on vacation. So
right.
It's a big change. A lot of people are adjusting to.
Well, David, we're hearing, of course, a lot of industries that are suffering in this, and in some of the economic packages that have just been passed is aimed to help some of these industries, but it seems like the losses that are facing the airline industry, we're hearing that airlines essentially could be shut down in America. How close are we to that where we may not be able to get a flight if we needed one?
Well, it's already happening. The airlines have scaled back their schedules significantly. They've cut flights and eliminated a lot of service to, in most cases, from what I understand, that they're not, you know, if they only have one flight a day to one city, they're keeping that flight a day, or if it's just three a week to a certain area, they're keeping that service. But if they've got, you know, 12 or 15 a day from O'Hare to New York, that might scale back to just three or four, because the planes that they're flying are virtually empty. I'm hearing about, passenger loads of, you know, 10 to 20%, and in some cases, just a handful of people on each flight. The statistics from the Transportation Security Administration are just staggering. Yesterday, in airports all around the country, the TSA screened only about 203,000 people. That compares to the same Thursday last year of 2.4 million. So you're talking a drop-off of more than 90% of the number of people who are going through airport security screening and thus getting on airplanes, of just a magnitude that we've never seen before. And it's continuing. It's every day it drops by another 20, 30, 40,000 people. And we could be approaching a virtual shutdown of air travel nationally. Now, the package that is being voted on in the House of Representatives in Congress today will require the airlines to take the financial aid to continue flying. So they would continue operations. It's just unclear if they really want them to continue flying empty planes.
So, but it's just not the airlines that are suffering too. We're hearing, of course, cutbacks with transit, with just taking a train, getting into downtown Chicago or elsewhere. How do you know how it's affecting things like, say, Amtrak?
Yeah, Amtrak ridership is, people are just not traveling really anywhere. It's not just that we're now shifting from flying to driving or taking the train, or from taking the train or the bus to, driving to work. People aren't leaving their homes for the most part, unless they really, really have to. And therefore, yeah, mass transit systems are seeing a huge drop in ridership. Depending on the city, it's 50 to 90%. I talked to a few experts about the heaviest, most hardest hit cities appear to be places where the coronavirus outbreaks have been most severe. So New York City, Seattle, Chicago is certainly down significantly. And Amtrak too. Yeah, I mean the lines that serve, the Northeast corridor in particular are hard hit because those are very popular trains. The Acela, the high speed rail service that goes from Washington D.C. up to Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. A big decline in ridership there, and a lot of the Midwest routes too. Not many people getting on the train. So the package that Congress is voting on today does have $1 billion to help support Amtrak through this downturn, in addition to the $60 billion plus that the airlines will have available to them.
Well, David, but let me ask you this. With the stimulus package, you need that to kind of sustain these industries. But at the same time, if people aren't traveling, how far can even the stimulus help with that? Because at some point, they're going to need people back on the airplanes, trains, and automobiles.
Yeah, Mike, it's a good question because, we don't know how long this is going to last. We don't know how long people are going to stop flying. The airline schedule changes that they're making, the elimination of flights, suspension of service, that's going into May. There are many industry analysts and people who crunch the numbers for a living who project that it's going to be late summer before a lot of people start flying again. There's a lot of hope that they might be doing it in June, in July, and the summer vacation travel season, but it's looking more and more like this is going to be a long-term thing where folks are going to be restricted in where they can travel, and every aspect of the industries, whether it be transit service and airlines to Amtrak to even, I'm seeing automakers starting to get a little concerned that people aren't coming out to the showrooms and buying cars. Okay. So there's a big, big, big impact on the transportation industry across the board.
Well, David, one last question I have, and I know you're a big baseball fan, big Cubs fan. So baseball season was supposed to start on both sides of the city for both teams, all of Major League Baseball. How tough is it for you not to at least have that sort of, escape and, tough day at work, get to look at baseball?
Yeah.
How tough is it to have it without it?
Well, I think the absence of sports is really missed by a lot of people across the board. But baseball has got a special place in a lot of our hearts. And I think you too, Mike, on the South Side, you love to just, there's something about spring baseball, when the the weather starts to warm up a little bit. The grass starts turning green. Sometimes it takes a little while. At Wrigley, you know, it's not until May that the ice comes out, but it's just a beautiful sight to see. And it just does kind of really take the sting out of everyday life to be able to go to the ballpark, regardless of how good or bad your team might be. And I got to ask you, Mike, I mean, this is the White Sox. I'm a Cubs fan, but I appreciate what the White Sox did this offseason, and they look to be a really good team and an up-and-coming team, and to not have them able to play has got to really sting, doesn't it?
It sure does. It sure does. Well, David Shaper is a great reporter with NPR. You can follow all of his stories on transit and everything. Seems like he's always on a plane, but not right now. So follow him on Twitter, on Facebook. David, thank you so much for joining us here on Off Mic.
Yeah, just real quickly, Mike, yes. I apologize. You might have heard a lot of heavy machinery outside of my house. One of the industries that's not slowing down is construction.
Hey.
And we've got construction crews in the street in front of my house.
You need something.
Yeah. All right. Yep. So
thank you, David. I appreciate
all right.
it.
Take care, Mike.
Thank you. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
On Monday, the governor issued a stay-at-home order that went into effect Wednesday. I'm Matt Pelzer. Next time on All In, our Friday pitch-in catches us up on the big statewide stories, like unemployment numbers, even postponing the 500. We'll also hear from a Ball State economist on some of the pragmatic reasoning behind what some may call price gouging during the pandemic. And an indie executive chef talks about how her world has changed. Join us. Join us every day at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. Of course, COVID-19 has changed every aspect of American life, and not for the better. And that goes for journalists, for print, radio, and TV. And joining me to talk about how reporting is changing, how in the COVID-19 era in reporting, is NBC5 Chicago's Regina Waldrop. Regina, how are you?
Hey, good morning, Michael. I'm doing great.
Good morning to you. Let me ask you this. Do you remember the last non-COVID-19 story you did?
No, I don't. Unfortunately, I don't.
I know, it's been tough. So I know a lot of reporters, you're seeing having that safe distance away from each other, and some are reporting from their living rooms. How has this COVID-19 changed for you and how you do your reporting?
Well, you know, in the morning, we used to have a morning meeting. You go in, you pitch your story, you really sell it. You can look the news management in their eyes and tell them about your story. We no longer do that. We meet. We have a conference call at 9 o'clock in the morning. You know, we pitch the stories. They decide what you get to do. And then you go from there. And so I don't even meet with my photographer anymore because we can no longer ride in the same vehicle. And that was a lot of the time when we would brainstorm on how we would approach the story. What are our elements? And now I can no longer ride with the photographer. We have to go in separate vehicles. I'm doing a lot of FaceTime interviews or Skype interviews from my car, trying to put the story together. And but it's a really important time for journalism right now. So these stories need to be told. And I like to say that, you know, everything that we do or that people need to know is not coming directly from the White House. We are on the ground. We're in these communities trying to get people the vital information that they need right now.
Regina, you know, obviously a lot of people, a lot of reporters are doing stories. We just heard that Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot shutting down the lakefront because people just aren't getting that message. What kind of pushback are you getting from, say, viewers or people who follow your work saying, hey, you know, the media is really making this much worse. It's not that bad. How do you balance or how are you reacting to that kind of commentary?
You know, I think early on we were getting a lot of those comments on social media that the media was pushing this. This wasn't a true story. But I believe it or not, those people, those naysayers kind of quieted down a little bit as we see, you know, the death toll continuing to rise and how it's impacting more people. I don't see that we're getting a lot of those comments on social media, and I myself, I don't typically respond back to people who are, you know, blaming me for putting this out there or that I'm doing this to sway the election or anything like that. I try to stay away from those people. I don't respond to them anymore. I don't feed the fire.
Now, obviously, journalism is about telling stories of people. With this pandemic, what are the type of stories you're going after right now?
Well, Michael, I'm going to be honest with you. I feel like we're not really telling the story in the underserved communities, in the homeless communities. I keep pitching those stories. I think that, you know, in Harvey and in Dixmoor and some places like that, they're not getting groceries delivered. I mean, sometimes in the morning I'm hearing these stories pitched about, you know, Instacart and getting your groceries delivered and e-learning. Are these underserved communities, I think they're grappling with this issue. You know, even before the coronavirus, these communities had problems with internet accessibility and buying groceries and food deserts. I think those are the stories I'm going to keep pushing now and in the coming weeks. You know, in Pilsen, Little Village, those are the stories. I think we're not really serving those viewers the way they need to be served and how they're dealing with this crisis right now.
How do you maintain, you're a very positive person. How do you maintain that being positive in a time of such despair?
Michael, that's a really tough question because this story impacts me as a journalist, but also as a person. I have a mother who's in a nursing home right now, and I've been doing nursing home stories about people not being able to visit their loved ones. And then I do that story, and then I turn around on the weekend, and I have to, you know, go to her window and just look in her window and do the same thing. And so, you know, I'm hanging in there day by day. You know, I'm hanging in there day by day because I know it is as bad as I have it. I know there's somebody out there who has it worse. And, even though I'm a journalist, I'm a spiritual person, and I know that it's going to get better from you know, the days in are going to get better. Every day is going to get a little bit better, and I just got to keep hope alive.
Well, my last question is, I told you I wasn't going to ask any personal questions, but if you follow Regina on Facebook, you know she has a family of turtles living with her. So I got to ask you, how are your turtles handling this?
In the morning, it's funny because in the morning, now that our morning meetings are held, I'm usually at home during the morning meeting. I have more time to hang out with my daughter and my tortoises. So they like to take a hot bath in the morning. And, of course, they like their variety of fruits and vegetables. So I've got to make sure the refrigerator's stocked because, you know, I can only go to the store for things I really need. And so I have to make sure I have a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables for them. And some of the stores are, unfortunately, I'm running low on kale. So, but I get to spend more time with them, and that always brightens my day to hang out with. I know it sounds weird, but to hang out with my tortoises in the morning before I start my day, it calms me.
Well, Regina Waldrop is a superstar reporter with NBC5 Chicago. You can follow all of her work at the NBC5 website. Regina, stay safe, and thank you so much for joining me here on Off Mic today.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
Keeping you informed is our mission. This crisis is not just affecting our health. Our livelihoods, our economy, our political system are all in flux. Morning Edition from NPR News brings you the latest updates from around the country and around the world related to this fast-moving story. Listen every weekday and stay connected.
Tune in for Morning Edition starting at 4 a.m. with local news at 6 a.m. here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
On Monday, the governor issued a stay-at-home order that went into effect Wednesday. I'm Matt Pelser. Next time on All In, our Friday pitch-in catches us up on the big statewide stories like unemployment numbers, even postponing the 500. We'll also hear from a Ball State economist on some of the pragmatic reasoning behind what some may call price gouging during the pandemic. And an indie executive chef talks about how her world has changed. Join us. Join us every day at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. With this pandemic, we're hearing about the lack of medical masks to protect nurses, doctors, and first responders.
here in Northwest Indiana. One group is working to make homemade masks. The effort is led by Dr. Sharon Jackson-Johnson. I had a chance to speak with her earlier this week.
I am a member of Indiana Surgical Associates. My senior partner is Tom Galuzis, and there are 12 surgeons in our group. We work with several area hospitals. I primarily work out of Methodist Southlake in Maryville and St. Mary's Hospital in Holbert, but we also cover Michigan City and Crown Point. I did not, I'm sorry, I hate to interrupt you.
No, it's okay. I was going to say, so are you actually also sewing the surgical masks, or are you getting people to do it?
So let me tell you a little bit about what's going on. So myself, there are lots of people thinking about what's happening with the shortages of PPE. You know, PPE is personal protective equipment, masks, gloves, hats, gowns that hospital workers need to do their work interacting with patients. So, you know, you read all these articles. There's articles in Forbes magazine. There are articles, you know, in New York Times, you know, everywhere talking about shortages in these supplies. And then you go in the hospital and you see that, you know, hospital managers and administrators are having to make, you know, tough decisions about how much of the supplies they allow out at any given time, which, you know, is hard on the floor when nurses feel that they're not covered and protected. So I had made a Facebook post about the shortages in PPE and was kind of brainstorming and thinking about ways that we could potentially help with that problem. And there is another physician, Dr. Stephanie Bryant, who is a family practice physician. She works primarily out of St. Mary's and Holbert, and we're both Facebook friends. And she also was thinking about this problem. Last week, we both made a post about it, got a lot of energy around it, and before we knew it, she had created a Facebook group, I had created a GoFundMe, and we find ourselves now working with over 5,000 people and having raised about $8,000 to try and get people in the community to make reusable masks that will be available when the hospital stores are depleted. And, you know, when we first got into this, we didn't really even know which hospitals were in the greatest need. It wasn't, you know, about a specific hospital system. We just knew, based on what we were hearing out of the community, that people needed us. And when we made the group, we started getting many, many emails, messages, texts from hospital systems, nursing homes, all over the region, and even as far away as South Bend, saying that they were in need of standard surgical masks. And, I mean, this is 2020, right? Like, they don't have, many places don't have access to a standard mask to protect their staff from not just COVID-19, but body fluids, the normal flu, you know, colds, the basics, right? So everyone across the country are asking supply chains for the exact same thing. Everybody wants a mask. Everybody wants gloves. Everybody wants bonnets and gowns. And so there will be shortages. And so we're just trying to play a small part. We want people in the community to have an easy, reproducible mask that is made out of cloth. It will be processed, collected at area hospitals, cleaned, and then distributed to hospital workers. It's their responsibility, the worker themselves, to wash it every day. But when they come back, they have something that they can depend on in their possession. That's the goal of the project.
Since you've made this posting, how many masks have any masks been made up until this point?
Absolutely. So we have a tally of masks that have been made. We actually have three admins that are working with us. And Mitchell Walsh is actually the person that is collecting that data. And thus far, we have at a minimum 500 masks that have been made. We can't just collect the masks at this point because the hospitals have to do things in a specific way. They're asking that we give them to the end of the week to put in place a collection. It has to be collection that is done in their foyer. then they have to have a system to sanitize, and then they have to have a system to store, right? So we're asking our home sewers to hold off. And so we're, you know, there's no, we don't have inventory yet. This just started not even 7 days ago. But from everything that Mitch is telling us, we have absolute commitment. I mean, so to put it in perspective, Dr. Brian and I bought 300 yards of fabric on Thursday. We bought 300 yards of duck canvas from Joann's, area Joann's in Northwest Indiana. We had the Joann stores to cut the pieces of fabric into one-yard portions. Each yard makes 15 masks. We then opened that up to the group and the public, because it's a public page. We opened it up, and within 48 hours, all of that fabric is gone. That means that there are people working in their homes on over 4,000 masks. So they may not be done yet. They may not be completed, but the commitment from the community is robust. I don't think people would get in their cars, go to Joann's, get canvas, and not complete the project. So my expectation is as soon as we tell them that St. Mary's in Hobart, Methodist Hospital in Maryville, and St. Anthony in Michigan City, as soon as we tell them that those sites are ready to receive those masks, they're coming in. So it's just a matter of time.
So if somebody wants to get involved with this, where should they go? The Facebook page, or is there someone they should call?
So there are two great ways to get involved with the project. If people want to get involved with the project and get all the information, it's a flood of information, but you can certainly go to the Facebook page. It's a public page, Masks for Northwest Indiana Healthcare Workers. Now, Northwest Indiana Healthcare Workers, I'm going to repeat it the way that it's written, Masks for NWI Healthcare Workers. It's a long name. Again, Masks for NWI Healthcare Workers. You can join the page. You can purchase fabric on your own, because we have depleted everything that has been purchased, and we're waiting to purchase more until we get this first round done and make sure that people are going to bring us the masks into the hospital. But as long as this first round goes well and we get good collection, I expect it's going to be about an 80% collection rate. Somebody is going to not get to do the project, you know, either because they get ill or for some other unforeseen circumstance. So I expect it's going to be, you know, 15 to 20% loss. It's an honor system. Nobody's signing anything. So, you know, in the interim, if someone wants to work on some masks, if they have duck canvas at home, then they can join the page, message us, let us know that you're going to commit and be involved. The administrator is Mitch Walsh. He'll make a note of your commitment. Other ways to get involved would be to wait for the second round of fabric to come in. If you don't have the ability to go out and buy your own fabric, we anticipate doing another round of fabric within the next week. And that information will be on the page. If you want to email us, you can also email us. And that email address is brand new. And that email address is maskmasks4nwi@gmail.com. Again, maskmasks4nwi@gmail.com.
Dr. Sharon Jackson Johnson, thank you so much for joining us here on Off Mic. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. We just heard a segment on a local group making medical masks for first responders. But there's another entity stepping up to make hand sanitizer with the country in short supply. 18th Street Distillery has transformed their rum, whiskey, and vodka stills into sanitizer makers at their location in Hammond. I stopped by this week and got a chance to speak with owner Drew Fox.
So just about a week ago, what was going through these vats?
A week ago would have been running our whiskey, which will be our rye whiskey, bourbon, and then obviously our gin. A week ago we'd have been running that in our vats.
So what gave you the idea that instead of making whiskey and your gin that you could just make hand sanitizer?
Trust me, we'd rather be making whiskey or gin, and today we're going to ramp back up to our production on whiskey and gin. My wife's an ER nurse, and my biggest concern for her was basically being in the front lines of the epidemic. But more importantly, my mom and her mom are in their 70s, and I just couldn't bear the thought of my 6-month-old son losing both his grandparents. And so I knew we had the capability of doing it. We had played around with it before just for in-house use. And Raven, also one of our distillers, jumped on board and said, hey, we should probably, switch at least a week or two to try to see how much ethanol we can make for sanitizer. And so that's what we did.
And is there sort of like, sometimes you get makers of milk saying, oh, well, because it's almond milk, it's not real milk. Is this sort of like, medical grade hand sanitizer that you could buy in Walgreens?
Yeah, it's the same again. The base is going to be the ethanol, and then you have glycerol, which is the fuel, and peroxide and other compounds. A lot of hand sanitizer companies use different ingredients, but this is really a simple recipe that's been used around the world through the World Health Organization. And so we decided to keep it simple and pretty much use that recipe, which I know most distillers are using that same recipe or some form of that recipe.
And it's really good for just sanitizing your hands, protecting your hands.
Right. It's good for sanitizing your hand, any surfaces that you touch. More importantly, we don't want people to forget about, the number one focus is soap and water and hot water. It should be first and foremost. Hand sanitizer should be used, in my mind, as a second-to-last resort. But cleaning surfaces, for sure, if you're driving or using it at the gas pump, definitely use hand sanitizer. But soap and water will do the trick as well.
So how much of this, what is it actually called? It's not hand sanitizer. What is the scientific name of what you're making here?
It's sanitizer. So basically the base is ethanol, and that's basically what we would be producing for our gin, for our bourbon, and any other spirits that we would produce outside of rum, of course.
So how much have you made thus far, and when did you start?
We started last week, Thursday. Right now, we're sitting at about 1,000 gallons right now. So we've been running our stills pretty much 24/7. We have 4 stills. This is our main copper pot still, which is 250 gallons. And then we have our gin still, which is going to be switched over. This will be our dedicated ethanol producer for sanitizer starting today. And then we have back here 2 small R&D stills, which are about 25 gallons apiece. Our gin still is 40 gallons. But as I said, we're going to switch back to, we're still running a business. So we're going to switch back to producing, whiskey, gin, and bourbon. So our gin still will be our main still for producing ethanol for sanitizer. So we're making that switch today just so we can continue to run our business.
And are these going out in smaller bottles to hospitals, nurses, whomever needs it?
Yeah, so basically what we're doing first is taking care of first responders, which would be EMTs, fire department, police departments, and then hospitals as well. So basically those individuals will get bulk product. We have spray bottles that we are giving them, but they'll get the bulk product and they can refill. and then anything left over we'll send out to the community. We did yesterday about 200 bottles to the community. We'll do the same thing today based on what we have left over. You know, and on a side note, yesterday we got an amazing donation from Mayor Tom McDermott in the city of Hammond. The Waterworks Department had 10,000 bottles in their storage facility, and that was given to us today. So that was a huge donation. That really helps us continue to keep up with production, but also, again, keep in mind, this is free. We're not making any money from this. We're giving all this product away to first responders, and anything left over, we're giving it to seniors first, and then after that, anyone else available in the community.
Is this mostly Northwest Indiana or is it Chicago?
I mean, honestly, if right now where we're at, we want to take care of Northwest Indiana first, but obviously if a first responders in Chicago were to call, we would definitely help them out if we have product available.
Now, I know, I tell you what, I don't know the name of it. I went to your 18th Street Brewery in Gary like a year or two ago and had the most delicious beer I ever had. I don't know if it's called Arctic. It was something in the wintertime. It was great. So what are some of the other names of your famous beers that you have?
I mean, for on the beer side, not the distillery side, you know, one of our most famous beers is Hunter, which is our double milk stout. Deal with the Devil, which is a double IPA. You know, those are Sex and Candy, our pale, Best Patio Pills. Those are some of our flagship beers. Candy Crushable. Those are some of the beers that we produce year-round.
And from your distillery, what are your whiskey and gin?
Yeah, from our distillery, you know, all of our product we produce here, our rye whiskey, bourbon, gin, rum, vodka, you know, we're probably, you know, small and mighty, but, you know, we're, you know, one of the most award-winning distilleries in Northwest Indiana. So we really take great pride in what we produce and take great care in what we're producing. So this is, you know, going back to the community. So we want to do our part. You know, not most people have the means to do it. Not saying necessarily we have the means, but, you know, donations are coming in through our GoFundMe page, which has been great. And then, you know, the multitude of donations from local businesses, it's been significant. It's been great.
What's the main ingredient you need as far as donations? Is it mostly bottles or do you need the actual ingredients?
You know, we're not going to say no to anything. You know, we received another donation this morning from a local farmer. We received some corn, which is great because that'll help us make the mash that we need to ferment to make ethanol. Mainly, bottles would be one. You know, peroxide is in has a big shortage right now, so peroxide would be another one ingredient. Aloe, anything that people want to donate to help the cause, we're not going to say no. Again, this is all community driven. This is on the hard work of, you know, our volunteers, and you know, we laid a lot of people off. They're coming in and helping us volunteer. So anything would help this cause and help us continue to be a driving force behind this pandemic.
You started in Gary, what, about maybe 6-7 years ago?
I started the company in 2010. We opened our first brew pub in December of 2013.
And when did you open this?
We opened Hammond the beginning of 2015.
And those aloe bottles there somehow get added to the mix.
Right. So there's, you know, a couple compounds that you want to use and follow the recipe. Aloe is one of them, which is a glycerol. And then the other one is peroxide. So those are within the guidelines of the recipe that we're using. And most of the ethanol that we're blending back with that is roughly about 80% ethanol.
Could people make small batches of this at home?
If they have access to ethanol, sure. We wouldn't recommend it. We recommend it leaving it to the professionals. Ethanol is highly flammable. So once again, we recommend people leave it to the professionals who have the tools, the skill set, to do this. We don't want someone burning down their house trying to do this. We wouldn't recommend it or encourage it.
Are people using like just regular rubbing alcohol?
Absolutely. Rubbing alcohol is one of them as well. So, you know, if you can get access to it, yeah, for sure use rubbing alcohol.
And that's 18th Street Distillery owner Drew Fox. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
On Monday, the governor issued a stay-at-home order that went into effect Wednesday. I'm Matt Pelser. Next time on All In, our Friday pitch-in catches us up on the big statewide stories like unemployment numbers, even postponing the 500. We'll also hear from a Ball State economist on some of the pragmatic reasoning behind what some may call price gouging during the pandemic. And an indie executive chef talks about how her world has changed. Join us. Join us every day at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. What you've just been listening to is K-pop from the group BTS. They're a huge K-pop group out of Korea, and that music is popular with all the kids. But with this COVID-19, it's affecting everything. It's affecting sports, it's affecting music, and of course, it's affecting K-pop. And joining me to talk a little bit about this is one of my journalism students from Calumet College of St. Joseph, Hannah Carr. Hannah, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, Hannah, I've been wanting to have Hannah on for so long to talk about K-pop, not just because she's my student, but because she knows a lot about it. Now, Hannah, you know, this whole K-pop phenomenon, they started to feel the effects of the coronavirus way before we started paying attention to it, because you were going to concerts covering these groups. And tell us a little bit how you were, you know, coming in contact with some of this COVID-19 stuff.
Well, concert-wise, I know it goes back to early February. At one concert I went to for a group called Stray Kids, during their meet and greet, fans had to do a thermal scanner and wear hand sanitizer and face masks before they could go meet the group.
Yeah. And so right now, just like everything, but some of those shows started shutting down way before everything else started to shut down. And so that's what I'm saying. You started to notice that this thing may have been more serious than other people were taking it seriously, at least in this country.
Yeah, for sure. It mainly started over in Korea or Asia in general, where they were postponing concerts or fan meetings. And no one really registered how bad it was getting over here because they were still continuing with everything. And they only finally kicked in that how bad it has started becoming when tours and stuff started getting canceled over here.
Well, before all this started and everything, you were following K-pop. You go to a lot of the concerts, interviewing a lot of these stars. How, you know, like I said, I've been wanting to talk to you about how big a phenomenon is K-pop in the United States?
It's a lot bigger than people think it is. Some people don't talk about it on a regular basis, so you couldn't even know if someone is a fan in the first place or they know somebody who is a fan.
All right. And you know, you cover a lot of these groups and how they're dealing with it in South Korea. And from some of the reports you've been looking at, does it seem like South Korea is starting to recover from the coronavirus?
Oh, yeah, they really are. The number of new cases has dropped significantly. When the virus first started coming into the area, they had everybody come through and do testing. Even if you showed no symptoms, they had a drive-through in multiple locations. And they were more conscious about being careful and what they should and shouldn't do. And it kind of like took out the fire pretty fast. So it didn't become a panic.
Do you think here in the United States, we're not heeding the lessons or the following in the footsteps of South Korea, that maybe we should be doing that in this country?
I think some people took it too lightly in the beginning. And I know down in Florida, like there were kids in their early 20s saying, I don't care, it's not going to affect me. But now we are going to the point where we have to shut down everything. Unlike other countries, they were just had to take certain precautions, but people followed those precautions and they were able to keep moving on with life. But now we have to have a nationwide shutdown, basically, just to get this thing under control.
Now, Hannah, I know you're going to be graduating this year. How disappointing, or tell me, how is it affecting you as a student? I know we're not taking classes in person anymore. What does it mean to you you're not going to have a chance now to graduate in person at the commencement?
It's saddening, but I can understand the situation we're in, because usually at graduations we have a bunch of older people, like grandparents and all that, going to be there, and a large number of people being in one place could be bad for them. Like, you could have a huge spread. Like, I do understand, but at the same time, I wish I could still have that chance for the graduation. But so it's just like got taken from me all of a sudden, because again, like, we weren't taking it seriously. We're like, oh, we'll just see a couple weeks and we'll be back to normal. And now it's ranging for months.
And are you worried how this may affect your job prospects once you do get that degree?
I do, especially since it's hard to go out and do interviews and stuff like that, trying to get a job because everything is closing down or they just can't have people coming in. So yeah, it's definitely affecting that.
Well, Hannah Carr is a student, a senior at Calumet College of St. Joseph, and an aspiring entertainment K-pop writer and journalist. Hannah, thank you so much, and keep your head up. Things are going to get better.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Hannah. And we'll be back with more Off Mic.
On Monday, the governor issued a stay-at-home order that went into effect Wednesday. I'm Matt Pelzer. Next time on All In, our Friday pitch-in catches us up on the big statewide stories, like unemployment numbers, even postponing the 500. We'll also hear from a Ball State economist on some of the pragmatic reasoning behind what some may call price gouging during the pandemic. And an indie executive chef talks about how her world has changed. Join us. Join us every day at noon here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
From celebrity interviews to upcoming local entertainment events, Midwest Beat has you covered. Music, art, comedy, magic, Tom Lounges has covered it all. Join Tom Lounges on Midwest Beat as he continues to get you the latest stories on all your favorite artists and your favorite you haven't heard yet. Listen to Midwest Beat every Friday at 1 and again at 7 p.m. right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM.
Well, welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. And we're going to wrap up this show, of course, with our sports contributor, Cheryl Ray Stout. Cheryl, how are you doing?
Well, and yourself?
I'm fine. Well, yesterday was supposed to be the start of the Major League Baseball season. That's postponed. We heard about the Indy 500 getting pushed back from Memorial Day weekend to late August. Cheryl, how are you coping as a sports writer right now?
Well, I'm finding other stories. I've called some Olympic hopefuls that had their dreams dashed this year, and some of them may not be able to go to the Olympics next year because of age and financial reasons. But we do have some decent news about baseball. The owners and players have agreed to a deal because, you know, this is going to be an interesting season. They're going to try to get as many games as they can in. They know it's going to be possibly a shortened season, so they'll probably have doubleheaders. They're going to probably expand the postseason. And also, the postseason will likely be played in neutral sites because of the weather issue. That's a big deal. And also, players that would be going into free agency, their service time will count from last season. So there's some real interesting bites in this. Here's the other tidbit. They are talking about having a 5-round draft, which means any player that would have been taken after that would only be given a $20,000 contract.
Wow, that's really impacting. Have we heard anything about how the NFL may handle, say, things like training camp?
Nothing yet. The only thing we know for sure is that they're definitely going to have the draft on April 23rd through the 25th. So we have not heard anything. They've been canceling some of the events that they were supposed to be having. So I think bit by bit we're going to hear more what the NFL is going to do. Training camps, you know, that's in July. But the mini camps, those are important. Those come up in the next couple of months. So we have to listen to see if they're going to be canceling those.
Well, Cheryl, that's all the time we have for. I know it was a short segment. You can hear all of Cheryl Ray Stout's reports on WBEZ. Cheryl, thank you so much.
Have a good day.
Well, that's our show for today. You can hear this program again on lakeshorepublicradio.org or on the NPR app. Thank you for listening to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio with me, Michael Puente. Want to thank my producer, Jose Rodriguez, Dee Dotson, Tom Maloney, and all the anchors here, Sharon Jackson, Chris Nolte, bringing you all the latest news on the coronavirus pandemic. You can hear me the rest of the week on WBEZ in Chicago. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. Wash those hands. Good night.